Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
I mean, that's our job, right? My job is to keep people's attention. For me, it comes with something additional that I don't think the engineers at Meta or ByteDance have, which is I have a set of principles about what I want to use that attention for.
Exactly.
Right. As opposed to whatever gets it. And whatever gets it is kind of the dominant ethos in the world right now. This idea of sort of attention, right. You know, getting attention is an end in itself so that you can accrue the power that comes with collective attention, as opposed to a means to some end. Typically, politicians are trying to get people's attention to persuade them of a point.
Hey, here's a question for you folks. How do you hold someone's attention once you've grabbed it? Right? Ever think about that? Have you ever thought about how someone holds your attention? And how did they get it in the first place? Well, I'm looking forward to diving into that and a whole lot more with my buddy Chris Hayes, who joins us to talk about his new book, The Siren's Call, How Attention Became the World's Most Endangered Resource. Chris is the Emmy Award-winning host of All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. And the New York Times bestselling author of A Colony in a Nation and Twilight of the Elites. His podcast, Why Is This Happening with Chris Hayes, is also a great conversation point to learn and to understand a lot of stuff out here that's happening, some of it complicated, some of it not so much, but all of it interesting. Again, we're going to get into The Siren's Call. I'm looking forward to the conversation. I think you're going to enjoy this one. Grab your notepad because there's a little bit of stuff you need to learn about and settle back for fun with my buddy Chris Hayes coming up right here next on the Michael Steele Podcast.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
Hey, folks, welcome to the Michael Steele Podcast. So, you know, every once in a while, you know, I get to have the fun and honor of flipping the script on my colleagues at MSNBC, who for 13 years now have largely grilled the hell out of me on a variety of topics. So it is with a great deal of fun and pleasure. I look forward to welcoming my buddy Chris Hayes to the Michael Steele Podcast. He is the host, as I noted to you guys, of a great program, weeknights on MSNBC, 8 p.m., All In with Chris Hayes. Hey, man, welcome.
It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Hey, look, you know, I always talk with friends because they ask a lot about you. A lot of folks are curious about you personally because they have kind of gotten to see you over the years and they, you know, they wonder your backstory. But the one thing they always come away with is like, damn, he is smart. And I'm like, yeah, he is.
I appreciate that. I appreciate that.
It comes across, but it doesn't come across in a way in which people are put off, which is what I think why your show works. You pull the curtain back in a way that helps people kind of contextualize the moment, but then relate it to something bigger, which is why your new book, The Siren's Call, is so exciting, because you, and we'll get into this, you connect a number of dots importantly, but in the first instance, you just kind of say what the dots are. You always kind of, you start from this idea that, you know, we're in this new space of how our attention spans and our connectivity to issues and world events, how that that idea of the attention span is an endangered species, if you will. What do you think people tend to pay attention to? And what does that mean for someone like yourself as a journalist? And now, not now, but also a host on a weeknight program reaching a very large audience. What does it mean for news and the media as we get ready for the next quarter of this century?
Well, I think what we pay attention to feels less and less within our control, which is the kind of starting point for the book and the inquiry, right? I talk about, you know, the book's title comes from the famous scene in Homer's Odyssey where Odysseus is, he's trying to get home and he's leaving Circe, and she says, look, you're going to come to these sirens, and if you follow their sound, they will warble you to death and you'll never see home again.
Right.
And so she instructs him to stuff wax in the ears of his men and then bind himself to the mast of the ship so that he can hear them, but they won't listen to him when he's telling them, go towards the sound so that the ship will be saved.
Right.
And I think that feeling of committing ourselves, wriggling on the mast, pulled by something that we feel the allure of, but feel like we shouldn't pay attention to, is basically the ubiquitous experience of contemporary life.
Yeah.
That we have the things we want to pay attention to, our friends, our families, our hobbies, our pursuits. And then there's the stuff tugging on us at all times that is intruding, that is, you know, sometimes seductive. And that's that experience to me is what life and what I call the attention age is all about. So that's where we sort of start, you know? And I'm curious if you, like, I think we have a sense of what we do want to pay attention to, which are mm-hmm. the things, our mm-hmm. interests and the people that we love. I mean, that a lot of this has to do with sociality, right? The idea that, like, the best thing to do is spend time with the people you love.
Yeah, but Chris, we found lately people don't like grandma as much as they used to.
Well, but that's, I mean, I think there's an interesting relationship here, right? Like, I do think, you know, when you track how much time, I write about this in the book when I'm talking about alienation. I mean, one of the things we've seen is people today spend more time alone than they ever have.
Yeah. Yeah.
And being alone is highly correlated with economic development. So basically what happens is, as almost a general rule, the more time, the more, the wealthier society gets, the more alone time you have. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a big part of the story here, because being alone, when we're embedded in social networks and around people, you might crave alone time, but you don't have that same problem of where you put your attention, because it's being occupied by the relationships in front of you.
It's an excellent way to start this conversation, because there are two points that come together right out of the gate. You talk about attention as an endangered resource, but then you see, at the same time, you start in the book, and I want to quote you here in the very beginning. What I want to argue here is that the scale of transformation we're experiencing is far more vast and more intimate than even the most panicked critics have understood. In other words, the problem with the main thrust of the current critique of the attention economy and the scourge of social media is that, with some notable exceptions, they don't actually go far enough. Connect that for me, because that I thought that was very interesting. In the idea that this, in this space, what we're talking about, that we're still not there yet.
Yeah. I think we tend to think about it. I think we tend to think about phones like it. I think the critique sort of is, we think about the phones like cigarettes, like it's this bad thing. It has some sort of toxic effects on us. We're addicted to it. There's people mm-hmm. making money off selling it. But, you know, cigarettes, you could get rid of cigarettes and, you know, nothing about the social order really changes. And I don't think that's quite true of what is actually happening here. The value of attention flows from a set of truths about modern life that are inescapable. And the phone addiction is a kind of byproduct of it. Mm-hmm. But the deep sense is, in the same way that industrial capitalism in the 19th century transformed work and labor and created a whole set of institutions around it. Like, you know, 300 years ago, people like didn't clock in the morning and clock out at night. This is all a creation of a certain historical moment, set of institutions. In that same way, a similar thing is being done to our attention now. That means that the totality of our institutions, our markets, all these things, the way that public life operates around the moving around of this scarce and valuable resource. And the phones are the kind of way that it presents itself to our lives.
Right.
But what's happening here is deeper and relates to like the way we are human now, in a way that like getting rid of cigarettes and airplanes or, you know, cutting yourself off doesn't.
So we're not even really scratching or haven't really scratched the surface of what is at the root of this whole attention problem that we have, which is ultimately what makes it an endangered resource, is this connection is yes, our phones is one piece of it, but there are other pieces.
Yes. And it's also, I think it's the thing that it is most like is the relationship we have to food and hunger. So, you know, the reason it's like food is you can quit smoking, you can quit drugs, you can quit alcohol. There are things that if you have a gambling problem, there are things you can abstain from.
Right.
Right. You can't abstain from food. So food has this centrality to our lives because it's a biological inheritance that you're going to have to deal with one way or the other. Okay. And so that fact that it's central means that we have very complicated relationships to food. And also we have an entire industrial set of corporations and forms of production that manipulate that biological inheritance we have.
Gotcha.
And the same thing happens with attention, right? So in that same way that like food is sort of central to what it means to be human, it's central to the way that we relate to each other. You can't abstain from it. You can't go away from it. Attention's the same way. It's central to what it means to be human. It's the source of what it is to be a conscious mind thinking about the world. You can't abstain from like paying attention to something. You have to pay attention to something. And there are enormous, powerful, and very rich corporations essentially exploiting our biological inheritance for their own ends, the way the, you know, people that sell soft drinks and, you know, fast food do.
Yeah, you note in the book, I have hosted an hour-long cable TV show on MSNBC. My background is in print journalism, but in my role as a TV anchor, my primary job is to sustain a baseline level of viewer attention that keeps the show on the air. Okay, so we can get into all of what that looks like what's behind that. But the core of what you're saying there is what you're communicating and what you're leveling up and putting in front of the viewer feeds into that sort of, that's, you're just another phone.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, that's our job, right? My job is to keep people's attention. For me, it comes with something additional that I don't think the engineers at Meta or ByteDance have, which is I have a set of principles about what I want to use that attention for.
Exactly.
Right. That they could be right or wrong, but they exist. I have an ethos. I have some set of things that I'm trying to marshal attention on behalf of, as opposed to whatever gets it. And whatever gets it is kind of the dominant ethos in the world right now.
Well, yeah, because you go on. It's interesting that you would say that the way you did, because you said from that position, it feels as if it can collapse at any time, that you can develop an almost sensory perception of the attention vibrations of the audience, the way a surfer learns the timing of a wave when it swells and when it crashes. And so you're constantly trying to balance that delivery, mm-hmm. right? That performance, right? You're riding the wave. But if the wave is shifting, you need to adapt. But the thing that's different for you, unlike ByteDance, unlike a lot of other things that grab people's attention, is that you have an ethos, a moral compass that corrects the wave.
Yeah, or tries to, is trying
or
to take,
or the wave.
I'm trying to go somewhere. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, that's what it is that I'm trying to go. So I'm trying to use the power of the platform and to use the degree to which I can collect people's attention in one place to some end. And I think that, you know, one of the weird nihilistic aspects of the kind of troll politics we now live in is this idea of sort of attention as an end of itself. Attention, right. You know, getting attention as an end of itself so that you can accrue the power that comes with collective attention. And as opposed to a means to some end. You know, right. Why is, you know, typically politicians are trying to get people's attention to persuade them of a point.
Is that what it is?
I don't know what it is. But I mean, like, it's interesting too, just to talk about this for a second. You know, you're obviously, you co-host The Weeknd on MSNBC.
Right.
And one of the things I like when I was a weekend morning host is the attentional imperatives are a little different. The way people watch the show is different. It's nicely, I think, looser. Like, you have more time, you have more space. You feel a different relationship to that,
yeah,
grabbing people.
Yeah.
Because, like podcasts, it's something that people have and they're listening and they're like folding laundry or they're making eggs while they do it. And that actually, I like that because I think that gives, yeah, more space. There's more you can do than when you have to like have someone, well, locked in like this the whole time.
That's an excellent point because you have more time for their attention, to grab, yeah, their attention, to hold their attention in a way that. Why is that? What is the difference between an hour on a Saturday morning and an hour at 8 p.m. on a Monday night?
It's so funny because I experienced
the audience.
Well, so I experienced this transition because I had a weekend morning show and then I went to primetime. So I think there's a few things. One, I think people are a little more mentally exhausted, which makes a big difference in terms of at night. Yes. Yeah. There's a sort of openness and clarity that comes on a weekend morning, particularly a weekend morning, right? You're not rushing to get out of the house.
You made it through the week.
Wow. And like, it's a nice moment almost to yourself of you're drinking coffee and maybe, the kids are up and they're sort of doing their thing. Like, you're open in a way that is different than if you've just done a nursing shift and you're home, right, and you're watching, right, me at night. You're just in a different mental space, you know? You got home from your job, you did dinner, kids are in bed. And I think that puts some pressure on me and on the show to kind of grab people more. I mean, we do like the big open, right? Like tonight on All In.
Right, right.
And that's all because we're trying to get...
Hello, wake up. Here we are.
Right, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Right, that's right.
Now, it's a fascinating point because it speaks to not just the differentiation between the audiences. Exact same people, let's argue, on a Monday night at 8 p.m. versus 8 a.m.
Yep.
on a Saturday morning.
Yep.
Exact same people, different
mindset. Yep.
Different mindset coming into that communication space.
And I think to go back to what I was saying about food before, the same people who can eat like farm to table salads and burgers and French fries, right? Like
hello.
Right. Exactly. Same.
That would be me.
And I think that's what's actually hopeful about this story is that we're not predestined in one direction or another. Like, we do have different attentional appetites. There are things that we do want to listen to in depth. If you find the right format for it or the right mental space that someone's in. I think podcasts are amazing at this. People are listening to this right now and they're on a walk or they're on a commute, right? Or they're driving around doing errands. That part of it is hopeful to me. The same audience might feel very twitchy and kind of short attention span in some contexts. Mm-hmm. And then those same people might be down for a 30-minute extended interview in another context.
Yeah. So that begs an important question. Why is our attention, why do you make the argument that it's an endangered resource, number one? And then number two, how the hell did it get this way? What, I mean, you address it at one point, you talk about, you know, toward the end of the 20th century, many wealthy nations began moving from an industrial manufacturing economy to a digital one.
Yep.
You talk about what happened in 1961 when 6 of the 10 largest U.S. companies by assets were all oil companies, and now how that even that transition has had an impact from where we are now to where we see today with, you know, Meta and Amazon sort of driving markets and ideas and conversation as opposed to, you know, Ford Motor and,
exactly.
and DuPont.
Yeah, so I think the way to understand this, I think let's start with what we call the information age, because I think everyone gets this idea, right? That the economy's central focus was physical production, industrial techniques, manufacturing, steel, stuff like that, right? And shifted to information technology.
Right.
The manipulation of bits and bytes, the entire growth of all kinds of different work people might do, like a health claims adjuster, you're not physically doing anything in the world. You're not making a thing, but you're doing valuable work. The key insight about this era that we think of as being an era in which information is the most important resource is that information is not the most important resource. Information is infinite. It's copyable. It's generative. There's tons of information everywhere. It's important to this economy, but it's not fixed and finite in the way that attention is. And the key insight comes from a brilliant economist and political scientist named Herb Simon, who in the 1970s said, information consumes something, and what it consumes is attention. And the more information is, the more strain there is on the attention. So what it means is that the information age is actually the attention age. And one way I talk about it in the book is this, and I use a metaphor that Lawrence Lessig, a brilliant scholar, had once used when he was talking about the difference between physical property and intellectual property. Mm-hmm. So this is what he says. He says, let's say you have a picnic table in your backyard and you've got a neighbor with a backyard. If the neighbor steals your idea for a picnic table, then they put a picnic table in their yard and like your life doesn't really change.
Right.
But if they steal your picnic table, right, then that's really different because you don't have one.
We're going to war.
Right. That maps onto the difference between information and attention. The neighbor taking your idea for picnic table is like information. It's copyable. It's generative. But if they take your picnic table, then you don't have it. And that's the way attention works. If someone takes your attention, then you don't have it anymore. If someone takes your data, you still have your data. Someone else might have it. Maybe 10 firms have your data right now, Michael Steele, or maybe 100 or maybe 1,000. You don't know. Right. It doesn't actually make a difference in your life. But if someone right now banged on that door, they would be taking something from you.
Yeah.
And so this is a key, and this is not my insight. Herb Simon saw this in 1972 when he wrote his paper, Making Decisions in an Information-Rich World. This key insight, I think, is so important for all of us to understand because we think of it as the information is the stuff with value. Information's everywhere. Information is important in this age. It's hugely important, but it's not the finite resource that people are competing for and making fortunes off of.
So is that why you talk, you frame it up the way you do in the book about corporations and companies in this time being less dominated by as information companies, but they are in the attention business?
Exactly. So when you think about those companies, you know, Google is fundamentally an attention company, and what they work off of and the reason they built the backbone for the modern internet is that they are, first of all, they have, you know, a search site that conserves your attention because when you go and you want to focus, you focus on the top of that box. That's the thing they monetize using AdWords, using AdWords, right? So what they're monetizing is your attention, and your focus. They also run the ad architecture for most of the internet. Same thing for Facebook, which through Instagram and WhatsApp and Facebook itself, Meta, are monetizing your attention at all times. It's true for Microsoft, whose, you know, gaming platform is one of the most profitable centers they have, and also whose operating system, like, is the place that your attention comes to rest for all of your work life, right?
Right.
You're looking at their screen. That is the thing. That's what their market share is. It's true for Apple that developed the smartphone that created the information age. And I would even argue it's true for Amazon, which Amazon has a much deeper connection to the physical world because they have to ship products and they have incredibly, insanely sophisticated logistics. But fundamentally, the thing they own, again, like Google, is your attention on that website and on that app and at the top of it. And what it means, what's amazing about Amazon, and the reason they're really an attention company, is the value of that is so high. How many times have you bought something from Amazon from a brand whose name was like RT973-J? And you're like, I have no idea, zero idea who I'm purchasing from.
You've been in my cart.
Like,
I see.
Like, who made this basketball jersey that I'm buying for my pickup games?
We don't care. In fact,
$4.99, it's coming to me. But the thing that I have is it showed up in the search box.
Here's the thing is why you're saying is so profoundly, like, right on spot, dead in the center, is that the attention game is such a highly sophisticated game played in a way that I, to be honest with you, I don't even think Jeff Bezos fully appreciates or appreciated at the time.
Not when they launched, no.
When they launched, is that there is stuff in your box, in your cart, that you've gone on and you've put in forks and all these forks come up, right? And you pick one and you go through. I bet you most people think that item was actually made by Amazon.
That's, I think a lot of people probably do. I think you're right.
That is how deep this goes in that what you're looking at, you're so tied in as a matter of your attention and how you value what you see from this entity that you think everything on that site they make.
Yeah, that's right.
When in fact, if Chris Hayes and Michael says, you know what, why don't we just create a little thing where we'll just go out and everybody can buy shit from somebody else, but they'll get it through us. Because that's essentially what he did, right? But people think
it's basically
as a manufacturing plant.
It's
manufacturing forks.
Yeah, it's a physical search site, basically.
Yeah.
It's a search site for physical items in the world. That's the core of the value. Now, of course, they have a much more difficult project than Google does because they have to get stuff around the world.
Right.
And that is like a non-trivial thing that they have mastered to a degree that's truly astounding. Often at the cost of like worker conditions and enormous drawbacks to how they've done it, but as a pure business case. But again, like to have all those, you know, there was something very clarifying that inauguration. To have all of the tech titans, right, whose businesses are fundamentally attention businesses, and then the guy whose sort of manipulation of attention is the kind of pillar of public life, like all there on the stage, it was a lot. It was a pretty a disconcertingly perfect picture.
Well, so you have just segue perfectly to where I wanted to go, the next step I wanted to take in opening up the audience to, again, the siren's call, how attention became the world's most endangered resource by our guest, Chris Hayes. In the book, you talk about, quote, at the dawn of this era of globalization, the post-Cold War expansion of global capital and the rapid reduction of trade barriers, Naomi Klein published her instant classic, No Logo. In it, she argued that the new version of capitalism, which increasingly outsourced production to China and the global South, meant that the relationship between product and brand had grown more and more attenuated. The brand now stood as the dominant feature of the product, not the shoe itself. But the little swoosh switched onto it, right? That whole little thing. Since many of today's best-known manufacturers no longer produce products and advertise them, she writes, but rather buy products and brand them. These companies are forever on the prowl for creative new ways to build and strengthen their brand images. What these companies produced primarily were not things, but images of their brands. Their real work lay not in manufacturing, but in marketing. That's Amazon.
Yeah.
And all of these other pieces. And so when you talk about this tableau of these five very wealthy oligarchs / robber barons, if we want to connect that tissue, right, to an earlier stage, that was the branding moment in so many respects by Donald Trump in this new information attention span game.
And what Naomi Klein is identifying in No Logo, which she wrote, you know, 3 years ago or so almost, is the sort of triumph of the brand over the product. That,
yes.
That in the sort of new economy, the brand matters more than the product. And Donald Trump is the ultimate example of that. I mean, we had the product, and when people had the product, they were like, I don't like the product.
Right.
The product kind of sucks.
Right.
But the further away you got from actually experiencing it, it was the brand. And it was the brand that got him elected the first time, and the brand that got him elected the second time. And the time he lost was when people experienced the product, not the brand. And so Trump is the ultimate example of this, the ultimate triumph of brand over product. And that's been his whole life has been selling crappy products, but with a good brand. That's like the entire Trump shtick.
That's it. The
products have never been good. The product, like, you know, the Taj Mahal Casino, like whatever it is, most of them have been bad. Most of them have been failures. It's the brand that has been the thing that he's built. And the brand fundamentally is a means of grabbing attention. Like, that's what a brand is. It grabs your attention. When you see the swoosh of the Nike or the three stripes.
Right.
Or the red MAGA hat, right? Like it accomplishes something attentionally. It grabs your attention. You notice it.
And what I would say it accomplishes that's important is it ascribes value. You ascribe a value to it. When you see the swoosh, your mind says, okay, this is a product I trust.
Yep.
This is a product I value. This is a product I want. That's what Trump has done in the land of politics. Is he has, through his use of attention-grabbing branding tactics, brought a lot of Americans to the point where they ascribe a value to the crack piece selling. And so they know that the watch is probably a knockoff of old Timex.
Yep.
Right? But the value they ascribe to the brand is what makes that watch valuable.
That's exactly right.
Makes the thing in front of them valuable.
Yep.
And that's what you expose in the book. And so we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk about this whole, how, now that we've kind of set up the argument, and I want to begin when we come back, Chris, to connect a couple of dots in some of the chapters that you have in the book, which I thought was very, very creatively done, how this concept of attention and branding played out in the 2024 election. My guest is Chris Hayes. We're going to have a little bit more fun with Chris and his new book, which is out now. It's a great one. The Siren's Call, How Attention Became the World's Most Endangered Resource. Chris Hayes and I will be back right after this.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii. Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts Naturescapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9. Selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.
All right, let's be real for a second. When was the last time you wore pants that actually felt good? I mean, we've all suffered through those stiff, uncomfortable pairs that leave us wishing we were still in our sweats. But that's not the case anymore, thanks to Public Rec. Public Rec is all about making sure you stay comfortable no matter what your day looks like. Whether I'm lounging at home, running errands, or just going out for food with friends, Public Rec has me covered with their comfortable hoodies, joggers, and other must-have pieces. And listen, you know you've struggled to find a hoodie that actually fits, right? You know what that's like. Well, Public Rec's got you. Their stuff is made to fit perfectly. Comfortable, but still sleek and flattering, just like I like it. I recently got a navy blue waffle knit hoodie from Public Rec, and it fits like a charm. I love shopping at Public Rec, and I think you will too. So right now, you can get 20% off your entire order with code STEEL at checkout. Yep, 20% off your order at publicrec.com. Just use that code STEEL and you're good to go. So make your New Year's resolution a comfortable one. No more pants that pinch, tug, or annoy. For a limited time, you can get 20% off at Public Rec by using code STEEL at checkout. Just head to publicrec.com, use code STEEL, and you're all set. Find your perfect fit and never compromise on comfort again. Public Rec, where comfort rules.
Welcome back, everybody, to the Michael Steel Podcast. Now, I told y'all, you know, you're going to have to get your notepad and you're going to be tested. You're going to be tested. I, when we bring the smarts, we want to make sure you get the smarts. And I'm really happy to have Chris here to talk about his new book, The Siren's Call. So, Chris, before we went to break, we were talking about this attention, the attention piece, the branding piece. And I want to connect that to what we saw play out in the 24 cycle. You talked a little bit about or alluded to it in referencing to some of the other points we were making going back in what mm-hmm. Trump was doing before. It's very interesting to me that, and I want to pull up the book, the part of the book I want to connect to, where you talked about the Lincoln-Douglas debates. And could you imagine, just as a quick side, could you imagine two politicians standing up in a town square with no microphones, no cell phones, no scripts, and just for 3 hours holding people's attention and talking with a high sophistication of detail.
Incredibly detailed, 60 minutes, 90 minutes at a time. It's really wild.
It's just, it really is wild. And what I want to connect, because I thought it was such an interesting point, was you have your chapter where you talk about the siren call itself. So that's the Odysseus yep. story and Circe, and you strap yourself in, because when you hear the call, baby, it's going to lure you down
yep.
A bad way. Then you talk about social attention. You have your chapter on social attention.
Yep.
And then you have public attention.
Yep.
And I thought, when I'm reading through those, I just found that to be an interesting connective point in the story that you're telling, of how we sort of move through this from the example of the Greek classic mm-hmm. to the Lincoln-Douglas debates to what we see playing yep. out now on social media. What do you think of that thought, and how do you see all of this playing out in certainly in the 24 cycle, but even now we are going into our second week of the new Trump administration?
Well, I think, you know, one of the defining features of this age and that makes it distinct is this experience of social attention from strangers that has now been democratized. You know, for most of the time humans are around, like, you only got social attention people paying attention to you socially if you knew them. Maybe, you know, a stranger in a bar or something, but never at scale.
Right.
The only people that experienced that were people who were famous in one way or the other. And fame goes all the way back to Alexander the Great. And, you know, there's, you can make arguments that there's other figures as well, but it was a tiny percentage of people that ever had to deal with social attention from strangers. And now that's been democratized for everyone. And it can really break a person because you are not conditioned. What you're conditioned for in your formative years is social attention from people you have actual relationships with.
Right.
And so when you start getting social attention from strangers, you can be mistaken to taking that as seriously as the ones as social attention from people you have relationships with.
Right, right. You kind of equate them to be almost the same thing.
And in fact, there's something, you know, destructive and even pathetic about chasing the social attention of strangers, but it's that brokenness that drives Donald Trump. And that now is the kind of thing that dominates public attention and public discourse. We're living in a world in which, because there's such competition for attention, and because what I call in the book the attentional regimes, things like the Lincoln-Douglas debates have broken down, right? The Lincoln-Douglas debates function because there's like rules for how they're going to talk. And there's a focal point substantively on slavery and slavery's, you know, and expansion.
Expansion, right.
They're not just talking about whatever. Like, the whole thing doesn't work if you don't have the regulation of an attention regime, both in terms of I'm going to talk for 60 minutes, you're going to respond in 30, and we're talking about the same thing. We're debating the same thing. Increasingly, what happens in our public discourse, because there's such distraction, is, you know, we talk about January 6th and Fox talks about Hunter Biden.
Right.
You know, it's like, we're not debating on the merits of, was the Hunter Biden pardon legit? What do we think of the January 6th pardons? Where there's two sides offering arguments. It's all a battle over where attention is drawn. And that's always been the case to a certain point, but because the competition has gotten so fierce and it's so intensely competitive in every moment, and there's so much pulling at our attention, what people are paying attention to ends up mattering more than making arguments about those things.
Yeah,
this is like sort of key thing that's happened to civic discourse. So we've seen the collapse of debate as a model. People aren't debating stuff.
No.
It's just who can aggregate the most attention on the thing that's most favorable to them, whether that's immigration or that's January 6th or whatever.
Well, a good example of that is, imagine a Donald Trump figure with a Donald Trump mindset with a understanding. And that's why I refer to him as the P.T. Barnum of modern politics, because he recognizes at the core how to grab attention, how to hold attention, how to shape that attention once he grabs it. Imagine that figure in a debate with Abraham Lincoln.
Right, exactly.
And during the course of a discussion on slavery, he started talking about the furniture in the colonies.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Back in the day, you know, or started going off about the King of England and how he wears his crown.
Yep.
What that says to me, and what Donald Trump does, is that he knows that out there in this universe, that there's somebody thinking about how the King of England wears his crown.
Yep.
So in the course of this discussion, I'm going to find a way. And Saturday Night is very good with the skit with the president, where it's almost like a train of thought list of things he's going to check down on.
Yep.
That is unconnected to the original point or question before him.
Right, because he's eminently distractible too, which is partly his power, because he can't focus either. And I think like one of the ways this manifested in the campaign, it was just really rare that we had debates on issues. So like one example was, one of the central foreign policy issues was the fact that there's this incredibly brutal war happening in Gaza. The American government is supporting the government of Israel, Netanyahu, in that war. There are many people in the Democratic coalition in particular who were unhappy with the war. And there's this question about what U.S. policy should be. We had a whole campaign where it never really got debated. Oh. And not debated because there was broad agreement, it was not to be because Donald Trump was like, it literally Donald Trump's position on this whole thing was, it never would have happened if I were president.
Right. Therefore.
So there was never engagement. There was no, like, no one's ever, it's like, and because these regimes have broken down where you have to force people, and the one place that it happened was the one debate between the two of them where he got his butt kicked. He did in the debate because he can't really debate. What he can do is he can draw attention, but if he's forced into any kind of format where he actually has to, like, argue, give reasons, defend, like, it just doesn't, it doesn't work.
Largely because he doesn't know anything, you know, and that's, that lack of knowledge, quite honestly, aligns with a vast majority of the population.
Sure. Yeah.
Right.
So, and the distractibility too. Like, it's like he is, you know, Donald Trump is in many ways, he, one of his advantages, because he comes from outside politics, he views politics through the sort of the prism that I think a lot of voters view it through.
Yeah. And so it makes it that much more challenging to have an honest debate, discussion of ideas around the big things that we are concerned about. So we boil it, what our attention span now translates into, and you see this a lot on TikTok, you see it a lot on Instagram, is emotional responses. So I'm going to emote what I think, for those of you who aren't watching, I put in air quotes, think, about this issue. I'm just going to emotionally respond to it, which is what, in essence, Donald Trump does, because he hasn't taken the time to actually intellectualize a response to the thing, which is getting back to the Lincoln-Douglas debates, which is what citizens did then. Because if I'm going to stand out in a field for 3 hours and listen to your ass, I'm going to be thinking about what you're saying. So there's an intellectual curiosity in the first part, on my part, before I get to what it is you're doing.
Totally. And I also want to be, like, clear here that, look, a lot of the features that we're talking about are just endemic to democracy and endemic to humans. People not wanting to argue, people having all sorts of biases, reacting with emotion. Like, that is all, like, 100% true. It's been true in different times. I mean, Lincoln famously lost that election, although it was elected by the state legislature, not directly by the people, but same point. But the conditions can cultivate or produce different kinds of forms of citizenship, you know, like, and we know for ourselves that different contexts put us in better or worse shape to pay attention to things or to think deeply about stuff. I mean, you know, when we're forced to in college, when you're reading difficult texts, like, you find a way to do that in a way that you don't in other parts of your life. Like, we have faculties and abilities as citizens that can be strengthened or cultivated depending on context. And my contention or argument in the book is, like, the context we're put in now is not the best one for us in terms of strengthening those abilities.
Well, yeah. And so, again, you know, it's like you read my mind and where I wanted to go with the points you're making, and that is, you talk about in the book about our humanity, and you connect our humanity, I think, in a very interesting way to all of this. You note, now our deepest neurological structure, human evolutionary inheritances, and social impulses are in a habitat designed to prey upon, to cultivate, distort, or destroy that which most fundamentally makes us human. What do you believe then is the thing or things that makes us human in this context? And how does all of that change? Folks, we're just talking about platforms, like social media platforms like TikTok. We haven't even discussed AI.
Right.
And what the hell AI can do to further distort this sense of humanity and how we connect it all through our attention to things.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the thing that makes us human is a desire, and I'm taking this from a Russian emigre philosopher named Alexander Kolyev, it's a desire for recognition, that we want to be seen as human by other humans. And that's the fundamental, like, covalent bond of relationships, of any relationship we have with other people, that, like, we see them as human, they see us as human. And social media gives us something that's like a synthetic version, which is attention,
right,
which is not recognition. So you're seeking recognition and you're getting instead attention. And you see, it drives people crazy. I mean, look at, I think Musk and Trump are, I mean, Musk is, I think he's been truly driven mad by social media. I genuinely think it's like just a case of someone who's, I think he had these instincts from the beginning, but I think they've just, they've broken him. They consumed him.
Yeah.
And so that's the kind of, there's a dark joke here, right? Which is we're chasing after something that this format can't provide.
Mm.
And that's the deep fulfillment that comes with actual human relationships with people, you know.
There is that. That's why I made the joke about, yeah, folks don't like grandma as much as they used to.
Yeah.
So I gotta let you go because I know you got stuff to do, and certainly out here promoting the book. But to the point you just made, then how do we begin to regain our minds and to own that attention, our own attention, you know, refocus our attention on the things that we should be focused on?
I think there's a few things. One, at the individual level, there's all kinds of ways that people are trying to create spaces where their attention is preserved. We're seeing it in schools. I think you're going to start to see, like, to go back to the smoking metaphor, I think you're going to start to see phones treated like cigarettes more and more in spaces, like bars, restaurants, and other places. Just, you just put them, you don't have them out. You put them in a cubby or a locker when you come in, that it's just like understood that, like, oh, we're just going to focus for this time that we're here, whether you're right in this bar or you're. So I think we're going to see more of that. Then there's one level of personal behavior. Then there's the kind of creation of of alternatives through either non-commercial forms of the internet or commercial forms that don't rely on the monetization of attention.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Signal is a great example where it's a nonprofit that runs a messaging app where they're not trying to make money off their users. And one of the weird things about the way that our internet and digital lives has developed is we're constantly in commercial spaces. It's like living your whole life inside a mall.
Yeah.
There used to be a non-commercial internet that gave birth to the open web and Wikipedia and all that stuff that has largely been foreclosed by the platforms. So building a non-commercial internet and non-commercial alternatives that don't rely on the monetization of attention, or even commercial alternatives that don't rely on the monetization of attention the way it works now, that rely on deep relationships with the people that you have as customers. And then finally, I think we're going to see regulation. I think this is coming. I don't know what it's going to look like yet, but we're going to have this sense that there's a group, the group of corporations that are controlling our attention. You saw it when it was a Chinese company doing it. You saw the backlash in Congress, right?
Right.
It's not that clear to me that it's that much better if it's American broligarchs.
Yes. Yes.
So.
Yes. No, that's a very interesting point. And it kind of reminds me of something today. I was doing Andrea Mitchell's show earlier today, and we were talking with the former acting director of ICE, and he was, you know, sort of laying out, you know, the recent activities by ICE in performing these raids and rounding up 1,000 people the night before. And I was sitting there, I was listening, and it really kind of gets to the point you were just thinking about how you kind of process some of this stuff. And I was like, so is this a situation which is worse in the minds of this, we've been told, a national security threat? Is it someone who's here illegally or TikTok?
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
right? Because now TikTok is not so much a national security
all
threat.
All of a sudden, that went away.
It went overnight. Away. But, the brown skin guy who just who just picked up your trash or mowed your lawn or moved or shoveled your snow, that guy.
Yeah, is no, it's a great point. It's amazing how malleable national security threat can be.
Yes.
As a concept.
And it really goes to the heart of what you talk about, the sirens call, because that's part of what you want to plug the wax in your ear against.
Yep.
So that you can remain objective in understanding not just what you're being told or being led to believe about the thing in front of you or the person in front of you or the event that's happening around you, but you then have an objective process in which you come to a conclusion as to what that is, and you're less and less reliant on Donald Trump Holman or anybody else telling you.
That's right. And not being having your attention pulled to them.
The sirens call, folks. How attention became the world's most endangered resource is out now. The author is my buddy, Chris Hayes. I love coming on this show because it is an intellectual romp in so many ways. But we laugh and we have fun with some very, very difficult and smart stuff. And he's written an incredibly smart and well done, insightful book about our attention to things.
Thank you, Michael. I had a great time, man. Thank you.
I appreciate it, Chris. Welcome back anytime. Again, the sirens call, how attention became the world's most endangered resource. Check it out now. You also want to check out Chris and in his conversations every night, weeknights on All In with Chris Hayes on MSNBC. And it's certainly, Chris, you also have your podcast that you're doing.
Why is this happening? You can check that out wherever you get your podcasts.
That's it. So again, thanks guys for sharing a little time with me and Chris. Don't forget to do the voodoo that I love you do, which is the download and the likes. We really appreciate that. And it's always a treat to have all that happen here on the Bulwark platform. Until next time, just stay smart, because there's a whole lot of BS out there. You just can't fall for it. All right, guys. Take care.
Thank you. Till next time.
Lowe's knows July 4th savings are worth celebrating. Right now, get up to 40% off select major appliances and get an additional 10% off two or more select major appliances. Plus, get three Scotts NatureScapes 1.5 cubic foot mulch bags for just $10. These deals are coming in hot. Lowe's, we help, you save. Valid through 7/9, selection varies by location. While supplies last, see Lowe's.com for more details. Excludes Alaska and Hawaii.